You're listening to the Bird Dog Babe podcast with my mom, Courtney Bastian.
This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan and Boss Shot Shells.
Generally hunting, especially the tightly regulated hunting we have on most of these upland game bird species at this point, isn't the serious impacts to populations like disturbance of habitats is. Especially sage grouse, it's a low enough level that it really doesn't matter compared to some of the large scale habitat changes that are affecting them. You know, things like wildfire, cheatgrass, yeah, development in places are the real culprits. So don't feel bad about grazing them, but there's nothing wrong with just wanting to watch a little bit too.
Hey, bird dog babes. My name is Courtney Bastian, and I am obsessed with all things bird dogs. And I'm here to share with you the stories, experiences, knowledge, and opinions from the women and a few guys in the industry that are killing it. I'm a Wisconsin girl living in a Montana world, mom and two incredible kiddos, wife and occasional assistant to a pro gun dog trainer, traveling the U.S. talking about canine nutrition while hunting, raising, and competing with my German wire hair pointers and Brocchi Italiano. As someone who started hunting later in life because I wanted to give my dogs the opportunity to do what they were bred to do, I'm here to help inspire, educate, and connect women to get their bird dogs out in the field and experience a bond like no other. So pour yourself a glass of wine and get ready to be challenged and encouraged while you learn. This is the Bird Dog Babe Podcast. Lek is a Swedish word that refers to the area where matrimonial affairs of animals occur. A lek site plays an important role during the spring mating season for sharp-tailed grouse, sage grouse, great snipe, and prairie chickens. This lekking behavior is an amazing sight to see if you ever get the opportunity. The birds that display here are among the most complex of bird mating rituals. The males strut, fan their unique tail features, and pop the bright-colored air sacs on their breasts to create a sound that can be heard 2 miles away. According to the Audubon Society, the loss of a lek to flooding, agriculture, or energy development, or other habitat destruction has profound consequences on the upland bird species that return to it each year. Joining me for this episode to discuss all things leks is Ken Plord, an upland game bird habitat specialist for Montana's Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. Ken shares his story of getting started in upland hunting, his favorite upland bird species, and the bird dogs he pursues them with. Ken dives deep into leks, how understanding them will help hunters, their biggest threats, and lek viewing etiquette. All right, let's get after it. This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan. What makes a great bird dog is genetics, training, and nutrition, and that's why I feed and trust Purina Pro Plan. With over 500 nutritionists, veterinarians, and scientists on staff, Pro Plan delivers a full spectrum of performance and specialized formulas to help bird dogs like yours excel at every stage of life. Pro Plan supports us, the breeders, owners, and trainers, the events we compete in, our national breed clubs, canine health research, and are committed partners to conservation groups such as Pheasants Forever, Rough Grouse Society, and Ducks Unlimited. 95 out of the top 100 dogs are fueled by the advanced nutrition of Purina Pro Plan. This episode is also presented by Boss Shot Shells. Copper-plated bismuth, Boss provides a better, more effective non-lead option than steel and are safe to use in Grandpa's gun. Available in 10, 12, 16, 20, 28 gauge, and 410 bore. Direct-to-consumer pricing and cases shipped directly to your door. Shoot Boss. Pattern your shotgun to make more clean and ethical shots, reduce crippling, and remove lead from the uplands, wetlands, and all lands. Find out more at BossShotShells.com. A big shout out to the people and partners that are helping me keep the MP3s rolling for this podcast. My Patreon patrons, the bread and butter, the peeps, the community of like-minded individuals that are eager to learn and offer to contribute. Join us for $5 per month on patreon.com/thebirddogbabe for exclusive discounts, content, and live Q&A sessions. 5% of your contribution goes to the AKC Canine Health Foundation and another 5% goes to conservation. Dakota 283, unparalleled protection for your dog's travel to and from your next adventure. My favorite is the G3 kennel, which has a recessed handle on top that makes it easy for me to lift in and out of my truck. The keyed pedal latching door makes me feel at ease on trips when I have to leave dogs in my truck when I stop for fuel. An added bonus is the drain hole in the back, which makes cleaning a breeze when my dog has been run hard and put away wet. Go to Dakota283.com and use promo code BIRDDOGBABE for 10% off. And by Siren, shotguns for women. Siren carries the only full line of women's shotguns. They are dedicated to providing the equipment and knowledge that makes shooting and hunting more enjoyable and less stressful. New or seasoned hunter, Siren offers multiple options that fit right out of the box. No more compromises. Go to SirenUSA.com and check out all the options available for upland, waterfowl, sporting, and trap shotguns.
Hey, Ken, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Courtney, thanks for having me on.
I have to apologize because when we originally talked about doing this, I was all about, let's talk about sharp-tailed grouse, and I was stoked about it. And as I was kind of putting some information for us to discuss, I got really caught up in this whole lek content, and I'm like, hey, is it okay if we switch topics to just talk about some leks? Because I just think it's such an intriguing part of these amazing birds and so important to moving forward in conservation with them. So thanks for steering away from that or to this topic with me.
Oh, no problem. It's leks are a fun and interesting aspect of grouse biology. So
yeah,
you know, always something that's fascinated me. So I have no problem diving into it as best I can anyways.
Perfect. So why don't you start off by introducing yourself, telling us a little bit about what you do to have our audience get to know who you are today.
Yeah, so my name is Ken Plord. I'm an upland game bird habitat specialist with Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and I work in Northeast Montana. I cover about 5 counties primarily in the very northeast corner of the state, and my job is mostly to work with private landowners to improve and conserve upland game bird habitats and provide access for game bird hunters. So kind of a two-part job in some ways.
Right. And you're an upland hunter yourself, in addition to having a career of following around these awesome birds. So how long have you been upland hunting, Ken?
So I started following my dad around when I was probably 10, you know, before I could carry a gun. I remember going on a few little pheasant hunts with him near where we grew up. And I've pretty much been an upland hunter ever since, along with, you know, a little bit of waterfowl, big game as well. So I do dabble in a little bit of everything, but I think some of the first hunting I ever did was upland hunting, and it stuck.
Yeah. Did you grow up in Montana as well?
Nope. I actually grew up in Southern New Hampshire. I'm a fellow Montana transplant like yourself.
Yeah.
So I moved out to Missoula for college about, hard to say, probably 12 years ago now, just about. I spent the whole start of my life in Southern New Hampshire.
So what kind of upland hunting did you all do in Southern New Hampshire?
Primarily, we didn't get out a ton. So mostly what we went after was some of the state stocked pheasants. Mm-hmm. Occasionally we tried for grouse there in Vermont with not a lot of success, but there was one of the pheasant release places was less than 10 minutes from my house. So we'd always go there, you know, opening day when it was crazy. And then as I grew up, I'd always pop over there a few times as well. With one of my first bird dogs.
So. Mm-hmm. So when you came out to school in Missoula, did you specifically come to Montana for the allure of all the different hunting opportunities here and, you know, the biology aspect of it?
Yes, it was both those things. You know, Missoula's got a very good upland or wildlife biology program. But I was certainly attracted to Montana because of the hunting and outdoor recreation. You know, every magazine and outdoor publication you read, Montana's in there about every about every single issue. And yeah, you know, growing up, I realized pretty early that, you know, I was into hunting enough that I wanted to do something with it for a career. And all those articles always talked about, you know, just asking your biologist for more information. And I figured it's probably just easier to become one. So that's how I ended up where I am is, you know, liked hunting enough to do it, something related to it full time. And it led me to Montana, and I haven't left yet.
So why, when you were in school, why did you, or did you do it later on where you chose that upland path versus other parts of the biological ecosystem?
So a little bit, you know, a little bit fell into it, but, you know, certainly some of it's got to do with my interests as well. I'd, you know, started probably my second year of school, started doing some field jobs, most of which were in eastern Montana, with a number of different things, including waterfowl, one of the refuges. I did some other things in different places, Alaska for waterfowl. I worked on sage grouse in southwest Montana. So this is all field technician type stuff. So just through just kind of a combination of luck and whatever, I landed, you know, a number of things having to do with birds and game birds as kind of technician level jobs. I worked two falls out in this corner of the state as a block management technician, which is our kind of our big access program in Montana, as some folks are familiar with. And that, my second season that fall, this job came open. I was encouraged to apply, and all that field experience lined up pretty well with this job. So I kind of just fell into it, you know, wasn't necessarily intentionally targeting being an upland game bird biologist, but it fit pretty well with what I like to do anyways. So I'm not sad about that.
Right. So now that you've been exposed to all the different species in Montana, the bird species, which one is your personal favorite to hunt?
It's sharptails, and it's pretty hard to replace that. they're just too fun to hunt. They work so well with a dog. They taste amazing. So I just like everything about them. You know, I certainly enjoy the other species we have. You know, I chase pheasants and huns as well, and occasionally get out for the forest grouse, but sharptails are number one in my book.
Nice. Do you prefer late season, early season, in between? What's your favorite time of the season to hunt them?
You know, you certainly chase them more in the early season because they're the only thing open, them and huns out here. But I will say, like, you know, sharptails, they're legendary for getting harder to hunt later in the season, but I think that really depends on the weather. This last fall, we had a very mild fall right through December, and I had some of the best sharptail hunting I've had really in, you know, November and December. So my favorite time is whenever it's good, I guess. usually, you know, by the time you get into October and November with big game seasons and waterfowl, you get tugged more directions. Sure. So I hunt them a little less often and, you know, later in October, November, and that's usually when they start to flock up anyways. But if I can get after them just about any time, I will.
Yeah. And you're an ideal sharp-tailed country right there as well.
Yeah. This corner of the state's hard to beat for someone that likes birds, a little bit of waterfowl, and a little bit of deer once in a while. It's a pretty good place to live.
Yeah. When did bird dogs come into your life?
So when I was little, we grew up, my dad had a yellow lab, you know, he had done some waterfowling and grouse hunting with her. But by the time I was old enough to hunt, she pretty much passed away right about as I hit, you know, probably 12 when I could carry a gun. So we didn't have a dog for a couple years. And I decided I wanted a bird dog for whatever reason. And I remember reading a billion different little books and things about what the right breed was. And ended up talking my parents into getting me a Vizsla right about as I started high school. And we barely knew what we were doing with pointy dogs. We got a little assistance from a pro for one or two little lessons. So he sort of showed me how to, you know, teach her heel and woe and things like that. And we did a burn and gun introduction with him, but if I remember right, he had some health problems, so we never really followed up much. So I'd say she only ever ended up half trained. But it was like the second season with her, you know, we'd done a few different little hunts here and there, but I do remember going out just the two of us to that place close to home after school. And, she pointed a bird and, you know, I shot it, and that was the first time I'd, you know, shot a bird over point over my own dog. And it was kind of all downhill from there. There's no turning back after that happened.
Right. Right. So now you currently have a wire hair. So did you go right from the Vizsla to a wire hair? Or did you have anything in between?
Nope. I just hopped over. So my Vizsla, she's still actually kicking. She's 15, I think, now.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Pretty slow. She lives with my parents. I keep telling her they have to make sure she stays alive to like come visit again in July.
Right.
But then, yeah, you know, so by the time I got done college, she was basically too old to leave home. And once I got this job, the first thing I did was get a pickup truck and a bird dog. I steered towards wire hairs. I knew I wanted a versatile dog. I had started doing a little bit more waterfowling. And again, just looking through the different breeds, it seemed like it would be a good fit for me. They're a little more laid back maybe than my Vizsla was in those days. Probably also gets a lot more exercise, but for whatever reason, I ended up getting into wire hairs, and my Pixie, she's been great. She's turned six in a couple weeks, and it's been a great run with her so far.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah. I, not that I'm a bias or anything, but I do think that German white hair pointers are the elite gun dog. And I'm sure I'm going to receive some messages on that comment, but
yeah, I certainly enjoy them. I do like all the breeds though. This will be a pretty good coincidence for you. But, so for Pixie's birthday in about 2 weeks, we're going to go pick up another puppy. And this one's going to be a Irish Setter from Kelly Aitken, who you talked to.
Oh, no way.
Yep.
Oh, that is so awesome. That is so cool, Ken. And I just saw some pictures and videos she posted yesterday. Did you see those of the 8-week-olds all on their pointing?
Yeah, I think, you know, she undersold herself a little bit on that podcast, saying they're all slow to develop. And then she's got this litter that's, they're all pointing at me. She's got some very nice dogs, and I'm just one of those people. I think I want to try all the breeds. I may have a wire hair after this, as a do it all dog, but, I'm pretty excited to mix things up and try a setter as well. So,
yeah, no, that's awesome. And I'm the same way as you are. I appreciate any good bird dog. I'm by no means a breed snob. Wire hairs are definitely my thing, and the Brocco's awesome complement to it for other reasons. But I like to watch good dogs work regardless of what breed they are. And pictures of those setter puppies, man, the style at 8 weeks old, pretty impressive.
Yeah, and that's part of what I was going for, just a little bit different style. And looks like I may have chose well. So,
yeah, I think so too.
Getting excited for it.
Cool. That's going to be really nice to see that red dog on the prairie too. What a pretty image I have in my head right now on that.
Yeah, I think it'll be good. I'm sure there's a few times when in tall brown grass it might get interesting, but that's what GPS collars are for. So.
Right. Exactly. Yep. Well, cool. I'm stoked for you. What cool news.
Yeah, so definitely.
When are you making that trip?
Less than 10 days now, Memorial Day weekend. So coming up pretty fast here.
Cool. Very cool.
Yep.
All right. Let's jump into our topic.
Sure.
So tell us, what the heck is a LEC?
So a LEC, is basically a communal breeding ground, where males of whatever species kind of all gather. They usually do some sort of courtship ritual that attracts females, and all the females will come through and pick a male to breed with. And it's really a breeding system, and it's found across all quite a few animal taxas. So it's not just birds like we are familiar with. Fruit flies do it, fallow deer, cichlid fish. So it's actually pretty widespread, but it's relatively uncommon at the same time. So although many different taxa do it, not too many species within each one really are known for lekking. And certainly probably some of the most famous and ones most folks are familiar with would be grouse and prairie grouse specifically.
Right. Which states and or regions can we typically find a lek in?
So they're pretty widespread in the North America. You know, there's a number of species that lek that most folks would think of. So sage grouse, prairie chickens, both greater and lesser, and then sharp-tailed grouse. So anywhere those species are found, which between all of them covers a pretty wide swath of country, you know, everywhere from Alaska with sharp-tailed grouse all the way to prairie chickens in Texas. There's sage grouse from Eastern California, and then, you know, all the way to sharp-tails and prairie chickens and, you know, parts of the upper Midwest. And sharp-tails even range over to Quebec in Canada. So pretty much the whole middle of the continent. You're probably not too far from a lekking species of some kind.
Okay. So we won't see anything out east or, well, you said Texas, but anything kind of east of that?
Yeah. So, you know, furthest east is, you know, Iowa, Indiana, Illinois. There's, you know, some in Michigan, but you get further that and most of the, you know, more woodland states, and that's where those species trickle off. You know, of course, some folks are familiar with the heath hen, which is basically a species or subspecies of prairie chicken that went extinct, but that used to be present on, you know, the northeast coasts, kind of the heath barrens up there, but that habitat's long been lost to development. So at one point you could have seen them all the way over the northeast corner of the country, but no more for them.
Interesting. No, I haven't heard of the heath hen. So that's like a subspecies of the chicken, the prairie chicken?
Yep. It was a subspecies, I believe, of greater prairie chicken. Subspecies or full species. I don't know what they settled on. Okay. The last one died on Martha's Vineyard a long time ago, over 100 years. I can't remember. It was 1800s or early 1900s. But most of them had died out on the mainland before then. You know, some of those best habitats were also ones that were great for development and farmland. So they're one of those species that, you know, same as a passenger pigeon, didn't make it through human development in the Americas.
Right. Before we kind of had all the conservation efforts coming into place.
Yep, certainly. Yeah, and I'm sure there's
chase laws.
Overhunting that would be part of that too. Mm-hmm. I think there's probably an article on Project Upland about heath hens, but if you look them up, there's some good history on them. It's interesting.
Yeah, that's definitely worth checking out. The leks, are they going to differ habitat wise of what they look like or how big they are depending on the species, or does that change within the location?
So yes and no. Generally across the species, it's going to be kind of a flatter, clearer site where they can see. Usually the vegetation's a little shorter, but at times, at least with sharp tails, I've seen them make it shorter, you know, in the middle of CRP fields, they'll just trample it down. But oftentimes it's areas that kind of already have shorter vegetation, like sage grouse will be usually a kind of a weird spot in the middle of the sagebrush, there's just none growing. Sometimes they're on elevated locations, especially sharp tails, you know, in the sandhills in Nebraska are known for lekking on ridgetops. But at the same time up here, I've seen them on hilltops and kind of just flat spots in low areas near waterways even. So it can vary a lot, but generally a kind of a flattish place they can have a good visibility and somewhat short vegetation.
Okay. Like, so size wise, like, are we thinking the size of a football field or the size?
That's another thing that can really vary. And it really depends on how many males are at a particular lek. So they can be as little as a, 10 or 20 feet in diameter if it's, a small lek with only a few males. And it can go, up to, I've seen one sage grouse lek that basically ran for a half mile. There was some pockets in there that were more concentrated, but broadly speaking, they were kind of grouse trickled out through that whole thing. I'd say the most common, it's probably, 5 to 10 yards in diameter for sharp tails, maybe a bit bigger for sage grouse on average. I'm not as familiar with prairie chickens, but I'm guessing they're similar to sharp tails. Most of them aren't huge, an area the size of your average living room, maybe.
Mm-hmm. So in that average size, how many would you see on there?
So it's a lot easier to count males and females. The males are on there most of the time, most of the days, certainly in spring. So that's how we usually kind of count leks and keep track of them is the number of males that are there. And again, this can be super variable depending upon the species and the location, the quality of habitat around. Generally, the minimum definition is, 2 males that are regularly displaying there, usually for multiple years. So as few as 2, but it can be more than 100 males, so especially with sage grouse.
Wow.
But on average, at least in Montana and our area, sharp tails is about 15 males per lek long term, and sage grouse is about 18. And then there's one or two studies that have tried to figure out how many females coincide to that number of males. No one's pinned it down very well, but maybe double or a little bit more. But they kind of trickle in and out, a few here and there any given day.
So what are the females doing that they're not necessarily there? Are they besides nesting, are they just venturing out more, whereas the males are just going to continue to stay in there and do their fancy dance in hopes to bring the girls in?
Yeah, pretty much. So, so one of the key features of kind of the lek mating system is the females basically have control. So, they have free choice. They can show up whenever they want to the party. They can leave whenever they want. So they'll just be out doing the normal routine, feeding, probably looking for areas to nest in around that time, but kind of just doing their daily routine. But when they're ready, they'll show up on a lek maybe for a day or a couple days, usually first thing in the morning. And when it's really active, there'll be a handful of females. Sometimes you'll see a bunch of them just kind of camped in the middle watching the boys dance. But other times, especially earlier and later in the season, they're either, early season, they're just out doing what they do. Many days there's no females that show up. And then Late in the season, after most of them have visited the lek for at least once, they'll be out initiating nests. And the males will stay on in case females come back, to recopulate or need to re-nest. So they'll stick around for longer into the spring, but there's kind of peak. And in most of the country, it's sometime in April, early to mid-April, depending upon latitude, is when the females will kind of show up in force for a week or two. On that, it's mostly a boys' club.
Do you know how far they'll venture away from their lek, like males or females?
I don't have some of those exact figures off the top of my head. But they stay within, a couple miles generally, and this can really vary. A couple miles maybe for sharp tails specifically. Sage grouse, there's some populations that are migratory, so that's certainly a little bit different. Okay. Most females will nest within a few miles of the lek they breed at. And you know, some females, it's likely they visit more than one lek in a season. For the most part, once a male picks a lek, it's thought they stick with it, especially older males. But yeah, most females, I want to say sharp tails, the average distance they nest, you know, 1 to 2 miles from the lek they breed at, sometimes less, sometimes more. They don't really care. And then sage grouse, you know, they average, I want to say around 1.5 miles. But I've seen some in certain terrains up to, you know, 5 miles away from where they bred. So it can vary, but they generally kind of stick in that area. That's basically their part of their home range is, you know, whatever leks they breed at.
Yeah. So how far apart will leks be from each other then typically if the females are maybe going to different ones?
So it can vary a lot, again, between different species. And this is one there's, again, not a ton of research on, just kind of anecdotal. At least around here where I've seen it, for sharp tails in the better habitats, you can really have a lek every square mile, if not a little more. Mm-hmm. And as habitat quality declines, as you know, maybe get more cropland or other suboptimal habitats or disturbance, you know, it's just going to be one every few miles where there is good habitat. Sage grouse is probably a little bit lower density than that on average, you know, a little more spread out even in the better habitats. And I wouldn't even want to guess for prairie chickens. That's way out of my league. Okay. So it can really vary a lot, but, you know, anywhere from, yeah, one every mile or so to one every few square miles or more.
That's a lot more than I thought there would be. Interesting.
Yeah. Specifically for sharp tails, there's a lot out there. And then even in the good habitats for sage grouse, they're pretty well scattered about.
With the habitat, is any of that man-made? I mean, are these leks, is there difficulty maintaining good habitat there that biologists and, you know, people are stepping in to try to help these out or even creating new ones?
No. So a lek isn't something we can necessarily create, but as long as you have general habitat for the species there, they're going to pick a spot. You know, there's some features of leks that we probably don't fully understand whatever they're keying in on. You know, again, there's some things we know, you know, shorter vegetation, maybe a little bit elevated. But other things, it's just hard to say. So the rule of thumb is, as long as you have the habitat, they'll figure out where they want to dance. One interesting kind of anecdotal note, you know, a couple years ago, there was some sage grouse that got translocated to Alberta from, you know, Northeast Montana, North Central Montana. And I do remember one of their biologists saying, you know, so these females got moved several hundred miles, and they had GPS collars, and at least one or two of them did kind of make some rounds in spring looking for, you know, leks. And they did visit some sites that were historic leks that had been, you know, long abandoned, which just probably indicates there's something on the landscape that they key in on that says this is probably a good spot to dance. So they kind of figure that out on their own. So there's things that we'll probably never know or understand what they want, but it probably comes genetically ingrained as to what to look for to find a good lek site. Mm-hmm. Once males are there, they certainly make a bunch of noise and call everyone in.
Yeah. Really interesting. So will the males, you know, depending on whether they're mature or juvenile, does that have a say if they're going to come back to that same one or if they'll go off and look for a new one? I mean, is there a lot of kind of territorial or, you know, I don't know, possessive behavior of these?
Yeah. So basically in its first year, you know, a young grouse after it leaves its brood, it's going to probably hop around a couple different leks and check out the males so that, you know, it'll probably check out a number of the different nearby ones and eventually settle on one. Once a male picks a lek, and kind of sets up their territory on one, they probably stick with it for pretty much their life at that point. So certainly once it's an adult male that's been dancing in a specific place, it's settled. But there's some indication that, yeah, early on there's probably a little flexibility in which lex a particular juvenile male decides to set up shop at. And it's another thing that's not really well studied, but yeah, it seems like they bounce around a little bit and find one that they like. But you know, that's probably from a selection that's usually pretty close to where they were raised.
Right. And on these lex where there are multiple males, is there still one male that is typically breeding the majority of the females there, or is that spread out kind of evenly?
Yep. So that's typically the case. Basically a lex, again, kind of a communal meeting area, but within the lex, a male's generally defending a small territory, you know, maybe a couple yards in size. And usually the better territories are towards the center, and, you know, the more mature dominant adults will have those better territories. And usually it's, yeah, a couple males there in the middle that are going to do most of the breeding. You know, a few of the other ones may get a chance occasionally, but, by and large, it's, you know, depending on how big the lek is, one or maybe a handful of birds that do most of it.
And at what time of the year are the leks most popular? When are we going to see the dancing going on?
So certainly spring is the main time, but that's not to say there isn't a bit of activity other times of year. And this is another thing that kind of varies a little bit with species. I'll stick with sharptails because I'm most familiar with them by far. But sharptail males will spend a fair bit of the year on or near the lek. Middle of summer is maybe the only time they don't go there super regularly, but, you know, starting in September, October, they start to show up on nice weather days. You know, the males will kind of hang out. They might do it, not as much dancing, but they will kind of show up for an hour and just hang out there. And that's, you know, theorized that's kind of when some of those young males, they're dispersing from their broods. They'll go check out some of those leks and maybe pick one and kind of start to learn, you know, maybe some of the intricacies. You know, they come pretty genetically ingrained with how to dance, but there could be some component of learning things from older males too. And then as, you know, fall goes on, yeah, they'll show up any nice weather day through winter. You know, even when it's cold, as long as it's sunny out, you know, they'll again be out there for an hour or two in the mornings, the males anyways. But by the time you hit March, you know, mid to late March is when things start to ramp up, and the dancing increases quite a bit as, you know, April approaches. Early April is when you start to see females show up here and there. And then the peak activity is, yeah, you know, middle of April for most of the grouse in the northern plains. Mm-hmm. Then kind of tapers off again as, yeah, females start to head out to nests. And then usually by probably middle to late June, that's when kind of things go dormant for a couple months again. There, you can always find birds kind of near leks, but that's probably the one time that they really don't dance much.
Okay. And when I was doing some reading with the sharptail, it was mentioned that the females, if they lose their clutch, that they'll go back to the lek, get bred again, and have a second one.
Yep. And, you know, so for most gallinaceous birds, most of our game birds will re-nest at least once. And it depends on when they lose their clutch, but especially if they lose it early, you know, whether it gets depredated or destroyed somehow. Yeah, they'll go back for another attempt. And usually that involves, yeah, going back to the lek, getting rebred. Mm-hmm. And that's why a lot of the males will stick around, you know, through May, even into maybe early June. There's always going to be one that's going to hang out there just in case someone shows up.
Yeah. And I mean, even thinking of like the length of our seasons, and some years it's longer than others. Oh, gosh, as I'm sitting here on May 20th, and there's 6 inches of snow on the ground in Western Montana. But, you know, what I noticed last year with rough grouse, and because I'm new here, I don't mm-hmm. necessarily understand if this is typical or not, but when rough grouse season started last year, there were some really young birds. And so is it possible that like sharp-tailed grouse, or I mean even rough grouse, but are there, is it possible to have two full clutches raised in one season?
So a single hen can't ever do double clutching like that, which, you know, that's okay. One, I think with some quail, they can pull off two in a year. But all our grouse or pheasants, partridge, they'll only raise one brood. So it kind of depends on when they lose a nest. Basically, if they lose a whole brood, they pretty much never re-nest. They become less likely to re-nest if they lose the nest real late in incubation. But, you know, in that first half or so, you know, there's always a lot of flexibility there. But especially if they lose it early, they're definitely likely to re-nest. And, yeah, some years, especially there's
so they'll be later,
make it likely to, you know, lose a bunch of nests. Yeah. You get a later hatch. And, you know, certainly even just the spring, you know, this year we had barely had a winter. So there's probably more birds that nested early. But other years, you know, you have snowpack right up until that mid-April time period when most birds want to start, you know, breeding and start a nest. So there can be a lot of variation in when, you know, I think the peak egg laying is. And yeah, it's pretty common to notice that those first couple weeks of the season. And even same with pheasants, sometimes they'll get a good wave of late hatch. And even in October, there's small birds that are, you know, barely colored up, if that, that hunters notice. And we had that a year or two ago up here. So yeah, it's definitely one of those things. There's a lot of variability in when the peak hatch is and how big those chicks can be once they hit the fall hunting season.
And this late season snow we have right now, that's pretty heavy. How is this going to affect our birds here in Western Montana?
So I'm not as good with some of the forest grouse. So I don't want to get an over.
Yeah, no.
Too big, but sure. Yeah, there's probably a good chance that, some early nests may get abandoned. If it's not too bad, I think for a day or so, sometimes, you know, if hens are actually incubating, they'll sit through it. If it's not gonna be too long. I think other times if it's not too cold, you know, you may lose an egg or two, but if they're still laying, they might still sit on that nest. So, you know, one or two might become inviable, but if that melts, you know, within a day or so, and basically gets back to normal pretty quick, they might just stick it out. So there's always impacts when you get some of this weird weather. But I think that, you know, it probably just depends on when an individual hen started a nest, what phase of the process she's in, whether she'll try to just abandon that one and re-nest or try to stick it out with what she's got.
Right. Yeah. It makes me wonder if we're going to have these young birds again in early season because of what just happened here. Cause the girls are going to re-nest.
Wouldn't be surprised if that was the case. It seems like, yeah, when you get some of the late winter weather, it seems to make it more likely to have some later broods. But so yeah, some of the intricacies of weather, it's hard to say, you know, these birds all did evolve with these kind of conditions. So it can throw them for a loop a little bit, but I'm always sometimes surprised at maybe how well they still manage to do despite some of the tough, weird weather. Sometimes I think they're tougher and better at producing than we maybe give them credit for.
Mm-hmm. What is their gestation and incubation periods?
So that varies a little bit by species and basically size. For sharp tails, they lay about an egg and about one and a quarter a day or so. So that, and it'll take them, you know, depends how many eggs they lay, but it'll take them, you know, 10, 15 days to do that. And then incubation for sharp tails is about 23 days. But, you know, you step up in size to a sage grouse, it takes more like one egg every day and a half for laying. So that might stretch out a little longer. And then their incubation is more like 25 to 29 days. So, it depends a little bit on the species, but, you know, somewhere in that 20 to 30 day period, plus another 10 or 15 for the actual egg laying. And so that's basically from, you know, that mid-April peak when they're breeding, they're starting to lay sometime shortly after that. And you give it, yeah, about, you know, maybe 40, 45 days is when your kind of first wave of broods are going to hit the ground.
And how many eggs are they laying in a clutch approximately?
So sharptails, the average is like 11 to 14. And that can vary with what part of the range you're in. I know, you know, it can vary quite a bit, anywhere from like 8 to 17 eggs. And there's probably some habitat and weather factors related. You know, if the winter and fall was really good and the spring nesting is really good, hens are in good shape, they probably lay a little bit more. So habitat quality ties into that. But yeah, on average, sharptails is 11 to 14. Sage grouse is a little less, 6 to 11. I'm not as familiar with some of the other prairie chickens. It's probably close to those sharptail numbers.
Okay.
And then if they do have to renest, it typically seems like they lose about 2 eggs each time. So, you know, they become less productive every time they have to try to renest. So, you know, if it goes from, you know, 11 down to 9, if they do a third renest, if they have to, it drops again. So that's where some of these really weird weather effects, if they get a lot of nests, you know, especially flooding and things like that, that's where your production can drop off on a kind of a landscape scale a bit, is you just, you know, the first that renest attempt, you're just losing eggs. They just can't be quite as productive at that point.
On that note, I mean, what are some of the bigger threats to the leks or the nesting areas?
So, you know, with all things, it's kind of just habitat loss and disturbance, you know, usually anthropomorphic or anthropogenic, so human disturbance of some kind. You know, for leks specifically, some species are a little more sensitive to others, but you know, things like putting up power lines, roads right next to them, energy development, you know, oil wells or wind farms, whatever it is. If you're putting something right by a lek, you could screw it up. Sage grouse are a little more sensitive than maybe some of the other species. Sharptails seem to be a little more resilient to some of those disturbances. I've seen sharptail leks change around, though, and, you know, if they were on a dancing on a hay field and that goes to crop, they might move. So yeah, the land use of the spot is certainly important as well. But pretty much, yeah, anything that any loss of habitat, anything that destroys the habitat or changes it substantially is going to be a risk to both, you know, lekking and nesting. And the greater the disturbance, the more impact you're going to have.
Are you seeing an increase in human disturbance in the lek areas?
It depends where you are in grouse range. And this is a thing that varies a bit over time. You know, certainly there's energy booms, and that's been a big challenge with some sage grouse areas in the last, you know, 20 years. You know, that's something a lot of folks hear about. And a lot of those sage grouse plans, they speak to not doing development within certain distances of leks. Sharptails and prairie chickens, a lot of the challenge is often when agriculture gets going. So when commodity prices rise, you know, you see more prairie or CRP get converted back to cropland. That can have a pretty big effect over large scales. And that can ebb and flow a little bit. You know, we've seen that since the 80s. You know, CRP came in strong. You got a big gain in grouse populations in a lot of areas. And then commodity prices got high in the early 2000s, and you know, you lost some habitat and lost bird numbers in places. So there's some variability as those things change, but you know, across the plains, we've certainly had a steady loss of habitat, you know, basically since the mid 1800s. So it's, you know, we're always seem to be encroaching on grouse habitat. And yeah, there's a slow, steady effect there as well.
In thinking of, I just read an article recently of the sage grouse that Project Upland put out, mm-hmm. And the fear in losing them. And, you know, I know we have a short season on them here in Montana, and, but, you know, to hunt these guys, I just think it's such a privilege. And we fear if we're going to have that in the future, if my kids will have that in the future, that opportunity. And so the allure to just watch these guys, you know, dance on the lek, that awesome dance that they do, it's almost more appealing. At least to me, than it is to pursue them, you know, during hunting season, just to admire these big, beautiful birds.
Yeah. And there's certainly something to that, you know, and
yeah,
kind of depends on you ask that, you know, there's certainly plenty of people who don't hunt that are just fascinated with the lekking bird species that, you know, they do
right.
Such interesting dances.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's nothing wrong with wanting to watch them. You know, it's probably worth mentioning generally hunting, especially the tightly regulated hunting we have on most of these upland game bird species at this point, isn't the serious impacts to populations like disturbance of habitats is, especially sage grouse, it's a low enough level that it really doesn't matter compared to some of the large scale habitat changes that are affecting them. Things like wildfire, cheatgrass, development in places are the real culprits. So don't feel bad about going to chase them. But there's nothing wrong with just wanting to watch a little bit too.
So can you touch on that a little bit? And I think of, you know, just this week I put out an episode on shed hunting. And as we were on our way to our training location last Saturday, all the public access areas were just loaded with vehicles and I didn't really understand why. And we stopped at a gas station and they were talking about all the shed hunters out right now. And so it made me think, you know, especially in your area, you guys have some nice trophy big game animals out there. Are you finding that this is causing any disturbance when they're looking for sheds?
So I think the first thing to say is I don't think it's anything that's been looked at scientifically. It probably varies a little bit by areas. Out here, no, we don't have that much shed hunting pressure. The perks of living in the middle of nowhere is there's not enough people to make problems like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's a few areas, maybe in sage grouse range, that could be a slight challenge. But by and large, I'd say recreation in spring probably isn't a huge impact on lekking grouse. Again, that's not to say some local areas couldn't be impacted a bit, but I don't think across the board that would have a huge impact. Where the concern usually is for shed hunting is actually affecting big game that haven't quite left their winter range yet. So it certainly can have an impact on game species. Nothing that I've seen is noted real concern for grouse.
Okay.
Anyways.
So if we want to see this awesome phenomenon at a lek, what are some etiquette tips that we can have to make sure we don't disturb them, but also be able to enjoy this awesome magical thing that they're doing?
Yeah. So, the most simple thing is just keep your distance a little bit. I'd say at least 100 yards, 100 to 150 is probably good for the most part. It depends on the species and where they're at. If you can stay in a vehicle and there are a considerable number of leks that are viewable pretty easily from vehicles, birds are generally quite a bit less disturbed by folks staying in vehicles than they are on foot. There has been a little bit of research with sharp-tailed lekking that I've seen on that. Cars never gobbled them up for the last couple centuries. So, so if you can stay in a car, 100, 150 yards away, turn off the engine, turn off lights, try to minimize movements is always good. Don't trespass on private lands, always an important one to mention. Quite a significant number of leks are on private land, certainly for sharp tails, but some sage grouse as well. the best times are going to be about a half hour before to a 1 hour after sunrise. Depending upon the lek and the location, it can be good to get there early. So if it's one that doesn't see much human pressure, it's probably good to get there about an hour before sunrise and stay till after they mostly leave, which might be an hour or two after sunrise. You know, if it's a spot, you know, near a county road, and plenty of them are, that probably see a lot of traffic, you know, I think that's a little less of a concern. You know, if they're 150 yards off a road that sees a bunch of cars and they don't move the lek, that probably is an indication they don't mind too much. So that's a situation where, you know, if you pulled up at sunrise, it wouldn't be the end of the world.
Okay.
And some of those advice, you know, folks want to photograph them, and that's where you maybe get more impacts, you know, trying to get really close. You know, the key there is to know what lek you're setting up at, you know, in advance, set up a blind probably well before an hour before sunrise and be in there all set up at least an hour before. You know, even setting up the blind the night before, kind of on the edge of the lek, you never want to put in the middle. But yeah, staying in there, staying quiet and staying through the whole performance would be key in those situations. And there's, a good resource is National Audubon Society's got Guide to Ethical Bird Watching, and Bird Photography. And they can go in more depth, and there's a number of other resources online, but a lot of it's common sense, you know, kind of stay your distance, don't move a lot, and you're probably in good shape. And then if you're noticing they seem impacted, you know, if they're either not displaying, their heads are alert a lot of the time, or if they're kind of crouched down like they're hiding from predators, that might be an indication you're too close or doing something they don't like. So if you kind of notice something doesn't seem normal, it might be worth backing off or leaving that one alone for the day.
Do you know, are there any actual viewing areas where, you know, whether it's Audubon Society or somebody has a specified viewing area? And I guess I can just say specifically to Montana right now that we can go.
Yes. So the two I'm aware of for Sharptail is both Benton Lake National Wildlife Refuge and Medicine Lake. For Sharptails have blinds set up. You know, these are kind of wooden blinds they set up at the start of the lekking season. You can reserve a morning in them. They have some of those similar requirements. You know, you show up early, leave after they're done. But you can call those places and reserve a slot. And that's true across quite a bit of, you know, Sharptailed and Prairie Chicken Range. There's a number of other wildlife refuges in the Great Plains I know of that do that. I don't know of a similar setup for sage grouse, but there are quite a bit of public lands you can view leks on. So in that situation, you know, including the Charles M. Russell National Wildlife Refuge, but also BLM land. So don't be afraid to call a local biologist in the area you're thinking of visiting, whether it's Fish, Wildlife, and Parks or that land management agency. Often they might have one or two of those spots that are kind of elects kind of near roads that they generally refer people to. So that can be another good way to maybe find some viewing opportunities in a specific spot if, you know, whatever's closest to where you want to go.
Okay. And what about online? Do you know any good places where people can just watch this online, whether it's live or just a recording?
Yeah, so certainly there's a pile of videos on YouTube of recordings, and I know there's a number of webcams. Your best bet would just be to Google whatever species you want.
Okay.
You know, I think that's another kind of thing that Audubon, maybe Cornell Lab Ornithology might have some good links on their web pages to lekking live cameras. But yeah, there's probably at least one is my guess for all the big species, you know, prairie chickens, sharptail, sage grouse. So that can certainly be a good way to check some.
Okay. And I mean, from what I can tell from your Instagram, you are quite the photographer yourself. and you get some pretty awesome photos of these birds. So what lens would you recommend for somebody that would maybe just be viewing from roadside from their vehicle?
So yeah, that's where the kind of photography versus just viewing comes in, where, you know, really good photos, you often want to set up a blind, like I said, close to the weck and be there, get in there earlier and stay later. And no matter what you do, the bigger telephoto lens you can have, the easier it makes it, because you can back mm-hmm. off a little bit. I've dabbled in it. I'm not as serious as some of the folks that go every chance they get.
sure. But you have better than what a cell phone camera could take.
Yeah, that's true. But even then I have to get pretty close. So I do use a blind when I've been out doing it. So if you want to get good pictures, yeah, either setting up a blind yourself or visiting one of those, you know, refuges or places that have a viewing blind. Those are probably close enough that even a decent digital camera with a little zoom, you'll get an okay picture. But otherwise, yeah, telephoto lens, probably at least 200 millimeters or more. Whatever you can afford is going to help a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then, okay. You know, from a vehicle, if all you have is a cell phone, if you have a spotting scope, some of the little phone scope things that mount your phone to the scope, those can do a lot for, you know, might not be professional quality pictures, but you can certainly get some pretty good photos and videos from, yeah, easily 100 yards away or more. So don't overlook that if folks already have, you know, some optics, and don't want to invest in a whole serious camera setup. That can be a really good compromise.
Is there anything that we can do, help the lek habitats?
So again, it's, you know, the broader scale habitat conservation is the biggest thing we can do. You know, whether that's supporting CRP, you know, helping conserve grasslands in the long term. So things like, you know, conservation easements, making sure that grass stays grass and doesn't go to crop or shopping malls. Those are probably the most critical things overall. Like I said, if you have the habitat, the leks are going to show up there. You know, certainly managing that habitat decently doesn't hurt. You know, if that's CRP having some disturbance every once in a while, so it doesn't just get old and less productive, can, you know, help production. You know, the one thing with a couple different species, sage grouse and I think lesser prairie chickens, you do see some of the fence marking. Near leks, ranchers or conservation organizations will go put out, they're basically small pieces of housing vinyl every few feet along a top wire of a fence. There's been a couple studies that show, yeah, sage grouse and certain, some prairie chickens in certain areas seem to hit fences a lot. It's really area and species dependent, but if you're in one of those areas, those measures can be helpful. Okay. And so if you're driving around, you know, in the middle of BLM land and see some weird things on a fence, that's probably what it is. So that's a small thing that some folks have done, but you know, again, the most important thing is habitat conservation and improvement at large scales. That's what really, you know, makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I think about a lot of dog trainers come out to Montana or South Dakota, North Dakota in this spring season to prepare dogs for their testing or their trialing season, and they're putting a little bit extra pressure on these young birds. Is there, I don't know, maybe something that they can look out for in some of these areas, or a better time when, you know, when the birds are going to be old enough to be able to handle that pressure?
Yeah. So certainly, you know, the biggest thing is avoiding the prime time, you know, especially if you can avoid that from mid-April to really August, if not mid-August, you know, that peak time when hens are on nests, you know, getting them off nests, like, again, can cause them to abandon them or re-nest, which is never good. So if you can kind of go before that peak or after most of the chicks are hatched and can start to fly pretty well, that's the biggest thing. You know, you don't want to be out there in, you know, middle of June when the tiny chicks are just hitting the ground. There has, you know, there is some research on that, that even if you're training on broods that are, you know, in late July, August, you know, brood success is going to decline if you're out there training on young birds, you know, but the one thing to kind of, the other flip side of that is, you know, you're preparing for hunting season and, you know, part of what we're doing in hunting season is harvesting birds anyways. So in some ways it's probably best to consider it a consumptive use, and just be aware that you're going to have some impacts, even if it's not dogs grabbing birds. Chicks are going to be less successful. It's okay that that's happening. We, you know, just have to put some thought into how much. And in most places, there's probably not enough dog training to matter, but, you know, it's certainly something folks that are doing it regularly should keep in mind, not hitting one area really hard. And yeah, certainly waiting till later in summer if possible, preferably.
You had mentioned earlier your favorite bird to pursue is the sharp tail. What do you have a favorite recipe for that?
I have a bunch I like. It's an excellent meat. It's kind of nice because it's a darker meat, but it's not nearly as strong like waterfowl. But it's got more flavor than things like, you know, a pheasant or a chicken. Mm-hmm. So it goes good with a lot of things. I love to throw it in Alfredo's. That might be one of the simplest, easy things, you know, just pan fry it and then, you know, get the edges nice and crispy and chop it up and throw it in a good Alfredo sauce and pasta. That I love that. Hangshaw's got a really cool recipe. I think it's called like Sharp Tails on the Prairie. And I think in his Pheasant Quail Cottontail book and maybe on his website. And that one includes, you know, includes some like rose hip jelly. I've used choke cherry jelly, but some kind of things it's inspired by the foods they eat. And that one, the sauce that it makes is pretty phenomenal. That one's really good. And then, yeah, you can pretty much do anything with them and it's going to taste good. It's like I said, one, at least personally, one of my favorite game meats.
Mm-hmm. I had sharp tail for the first time this last season. And, you know, I have to tell you, I heard stories that I wasn't going to like it and I loved it. I loved it.
Yeah. You don't see it. It doesn't have like a real strong off flavor, at least anywhere that I've seen, unless you screw up, you know, processing it. It's going to be pretty amazing.
Overcook it. Yeah. Overcooking is, I think, what happens to it.
That, and I think I'd say that's even a little more forgiving. It's a little more forgiving meat than I think some others for overcooking. As long as you get the guts out and it's not horrifically bloodshot, I haven't had many sharp tails that taste bad at all. Most of them are eating like grain, bugs, and forbs. So they eat a pretty nice diet, basically what most people would like a chicken to eat. So like I said, it's a bit darker meat, but other than that, it's pretty prime.
Yeah. Is their diet changing from early season to late season?
Yep, certainly. So for folks pursuing grouse, that can be kind of the most challenging thing about them in some ways. They start off, you know, start of September, they're probably potentially, depending on the year, still eating green forbs, you know, hoppers and bugs if they can, if it's still wet enough for them to be around. Pretty quickly into September, they'll start shifting to things like berries. And then as time goes on, usually to grain fields if they're nearby. Alfalfa fields, cut alfalfa is another thing they'll hit a lot, that green, fresh vegetation in September. So, yeah, one thing is I see a lot is it seems like in any given area, they'll be keying in on one food source 1 week and then it changes the next. So that can throw people for a loop, you know, where you might think birds are all going to be in the chokecherry thickets, but they're not, because they're out, you know, feeding on grasshoppers still and, or on the edge of grain fields. So they can be pretty variable in their diets, figuring out what they're keying in on any given week. It's not that hard, you know, you might just have to roam around a little bit more.
Right.
That can certainly affect where specifically they're hanging out on the landscape for 6 weeks of the season.
Yeah. So in my spots that I marked early season on Onyx, should I expect that they may not be there this year?
No. If you found them there before,
okay,
they're going to be there. And, you know, at a broad scale, they might be close. I think the trap some folks get into is trying to be really specific, you know, whether it's walking only the edge of grain fields or only the brushy draws. You know, and my advice is always, if you're not finding them where you think you're supposed to find them, just kind of broaden your search for a little bit. It might be that they're in a slightly different habitat pretty close by, is usually the case. I just think I see some folks maybe getting a little too zeroed in, and it might work for 1 week and it might not work the next. So just being flexible is always good. Yeah. You know, if folks have more questions or are interested in prairie grouse, whatever species that lives near them, you know, there's plenty of resources online. As I mentioned before, don't be afraid to call a local biologist, especially game bird biologist that works with them a lot. You know, there's plenty of other folks like me that are into them both personally and professionally, and we'll talk about them pretty endlessly. So yeah, don't be afraid to check around online or talk to people.
Yeah. So as far as a resource, if somebody was interested in coming out to Montana to hunt sharptail, can they call the FWP and ask for like general or even specific areas? How does that work?
Yeah. So that is probably good general advice for no matter where you're going. Never be afraid to call a biologist or a regional office. They'll probably direct you somewhere. It doesn't hurt if you found maybe a general area online and just want to confirm if that's where you want to be. But most of us aren't afraid to point you in the right direction. You know, if you're wanted to target sharptails, we'll send you more to sharptail habitat or sage grouse habitat if that's what you want. Good advice for most folks is just don't try to press someone too far. It might depend on who you're talking to. They might give you a kind of a town to base yourself out of, or a county. Usually when most biologists start getting wary is when someone wants to pin down the exact access area to go to, or, you know, drill down to specific spots. Good questions to ask are always, you know, what habitats to find birds in that general area. I think folks get a little leery when you try to drill down really specifically. Because usually it means you're going to end up sending them to your hunting spot. So be prepared to do a little bit of your own legwork. Don't ever be afraid to call and ask for general places to go. And we'll always steer you at least in the right direction.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Ken. I will be putting some information that we talked about in the show notes for people to go there and to be able to click on the link and get right directly to that information. But how can we connect with you and find out more on Montana's upland game hunting?
Yeah, so definitely visit the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks website. We do have some different sections on upland game birds, the research that goes on both for sharptails and sage grouse. There's a bunch of hunting resources. Folks can always email or call me. My contact information should be in there for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Region 6. And then, as you mentioned, you can find me on Instagram as well if you just want to check out some of my personal stuff. So,
some awesome bird photos.
And you have a few of those and Pixie, a little bit of bird dogs.
and follow your new upcoming puppy. That's going to be super exciting.
Yeah, there's a good likelihood that will be featured a fair bit the coming months. So.
So what's your plan with her come September? Are you going to get her out a little bit?
Oh, for sure. We'll be on Sharp Tail September 1st, as long as she seems to pick up training all right. We can, you know, get a gun introduction in place before September. I think we'll start the wild bird process for sure.
Perfect. And what's her name?
I don't know the name yet.
All right.
2 weeks once I pick her up. We'll see what fits.
Sounds good. Thank you so much, Ken. I appreciate it.
Nope. Thank you so much for having me on. It's nice to chat with someone who's very interested in birds and Lex.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bird Dog Babe podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, share it and tag me and someone that would benefit from listening. And hey, help a girl out by giving the podcast a rating and review on whichever platform you're listening from. Send me a screenshot of your review and I'll mail you out a Bird Dog Babe sticker. Be sure to join me on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And if you're interested in some Bird Dog Babe swag or gear that I rely on, be sure to check out the store on thebirddogbabe.com. And most importantly, don't forget to support the sponsors of this podcast and the organizations that are working hard to conserve the birds you're chasing after and the public lands in which you hunt.